Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. And welcome to the 77th episode of Robots. I'm Jana, and this is the second of our special two-part series on the European Robots Forum, hosted by Robot Darlin earlier in April this year. In the last episode, we heard from Jessica Carlson, representative of the Robot Darlin Initiative, Ole Swanstrom, head of ABB Product Management, and Moshe Shoham, CTO and founder of Mesa Robotics. And in this episode, we continue with the interviews from the European Robots Forum and we'll be listening to Bernd Liepert from KUKA and Rich Walker from Shadow Robot. But first, let's listen to the latest news in robotics with Christine.
Roboticist Heather Knight of Marilyn Monrobot and Carnegie Mellon University's Robotics Institute is organizing the first ever robot film festival. There's only one requirement for submissions. Feature a robot as one of the main characters or framing devices of the narrative. The deadline for your entry is June 5th. The actual festival and red carpet award ceremony for the Bot Oscars, also known as Boskers, will take place at the Three-Legged Dog Theater in Lower Manhattan from July 16th through 17th, 2011. Researchers at Germany's Aerospace Center DLR have shown how their well-known humanoid Justin can simultaneously catch two balls. What makes the feat even more impressive is that Justin accomplishes this autonomously. Unlike most other ball-catching robots, it does not use any external cameras or processing. Details of the robot and its software will be the topic of a presentation at next week's ICRA conference in Shanghai. If you can't make it to the conference, or don't want to wait that long, have a look at www.robotspodcast.com for a video explaining some of the things happening behind the scenes and showing Justin catching balls.
Since the successful launch of the first ever PC-based robot controller in 1996, KUKA Roboter GmbH, based in Augsburg, Germany, has been a leader in the field of interactive software, controller and mechanical systems. Today, KUKA offers customized robots, controllers and software for its various clients, ranging from automotive, food and drinks manufacturers to the foundry and forging industry. Adrian met Bernd Liepert from KUKA at the European Robots Forum.
Hello, Mr. Liepert, and welcome to Robots.
Hello, Adrian. It's a pleasure to meet you today.
Could you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, I'm the president of Europe. I'm with KUKA since 20 years, being CTO from KUKA. Started there 20 years ago in the development department. I studied mathematics and grew up to the technical advisor for the organization. KUKA is one of the biggest robot manufacturer worldwide.
Could you tell us what Europe is?
Europe is one of 36 European technology platforms, and Europe takes care of the European robotic business to strengthen this compared to the robotic activities in Japan, for example, or in US.
Can you briefly summarize robotics at KUKA?
Yeah, KUKA was one of the first companies starting with robotics worldwide when Mr. Engelberger came up with the first robot in US a couple of years later. It was, I think, 1973, KUKA came up with the first electric-driven robot. We continued in 1996 with the first PC-based robot controller worldwide, and now we have the new lightweight robot technology, just started the ramp-up of the product in the market.
The vision we got from films 20 or even 30 years ago was that by now robots would be all around us. Why hasn't this happened?
Yeah, we understood here in the symposium that one big open topic is still the safety issue. We have a lot of nice development and applications out there in the market, but academia didn't take care of safety, and we need safe systems at home. Perhaps you know about our approach with the RoboCoaster that came up in 2003, I guess. The first time not having a fence between a robot and a human being, and that was the start of this development. And only if you can guarantee that the robot is driven by a compliant control, which makes it possible that human-robot interaction is really safe, then I would accept to have robot at my home.
You've also mentioned the lightweight robot. Could you tell us a bit more about it, its target market, applications that you have in mind for it?
The lightweight robot, that's a wonderful example for the technology transfer from academia to industry. It's a development from the DLR Institute in Germany, Oberpfaffenhofen. And we took this, developed the product applications we have to have, and for example, this robot has 14 kilogram weight with 14 kilogram payload. That's a wonderful system. It's easy to put in place. It's reliable. You can use it for the human being robot interaction, and therefore it's a bridge between industrial robot and service robotic. In the industrial robot side, we can use it for assembly tasks, what we are already started. And in the on the side of the service robotic, it's the very beginning for medical applications.
So is service robotics the next big market, maybe the next big market for KUKA?
For sure, for sure. We believe that you only can survive as a big robot manufacturer in the future if you take care of industrial robot plus service robotic using the same platform technology, combining all the learnings from the industrial side, which are cost-efficient development, high-quality, high-reliable systems, combining with high-sophisticated algorithms we need for the service applications.
Do you see potential for industrial success in what are today mostly academic research projects, more futuristic projects, or do you see this more as a long term?
Yeah, it's more a long term. We have to concentrate, and that's one part of the next program from EC to make it easier to get academic solutions into real products. And as I just mentioned, one of these projects was the lightweight robot development at the research institute, DLR, in Oberpfaffenhofen, and now to move it over to an industry company, making it a product usable for industrial and service application. And that's what we have to concentrate on and what we have to do more and more.
Thank you, Mr. Lippert, for joining us on Robots.
You're very welcome.
Established in 1998, the UK-based Shadow Robot Company has recently developed what is considered to be the most advanced dexterous hand in the world. Extremely close to a human hand in design and ability, it provides 24 movements, and this allows direct mapping from a human hand to the robot. Among Shadow Robot's most famous clients are the BBC and NASA. At this year's European Robots Forum, Rich Walker, Managing Director of Shadow Robot, spoke to Adrian.
Hello, Rich, and welcome to Robots.
Hi, Adrian. It's great to be here.
So, could you please start by introducing yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, I'm Rich Walker. I'm the Managing Director of the Shadow Robot Company, which is a small company in the UK that specializes in humanoid robotics.
Your main product is the Shadow Hand.
We've spent about 10 years now building hands. When the organization that is now Shadow started. This is over 20 years ago. We were a group of people who built robots for fun. And the reason we did that was we felt that it was important that people were trying to build the general purpose robot. Marvin, Crichton, an android that does everything. No one seemed to be trying to do that. So our founder kind of said, well, let's do it. And we started building bipeds. Now, back in the late 80s, early 90s, no one really was building bipeds anywhere in the world. They were, it weren't a technology that people were doing. And so we thought someone had to go and do it. So we spent some years building bipeds. Then it turned out that Honda had been building bipeds for 10 years very quietly. And they came out with this biped on TV. And I do remember just watching the TV and going, oh, oh dear. And we had a long think about what we were going to do after that. And we realized that bipeds are good. Bipeds are great. They're fascinating. They're interesting. They're technical challenges. There's no market for bipeds because there's nothing for them to do apart from wander around. What we felt we needed to chase to go for the where we thought we were going, building a robot that could do everything, was to look at the human hand, because that's what lets us be able to manipulate, to move, to work in our environment. And we felt it was really important to take that technology, the human hand, and transfer that into robotics by some means. So we started a very long, slow process of building human-like hands for robots.
It's been a long journey. I imagine there were more steps.
Oh.
Could you detail a bit on that?
I mean, the first hand we built was in 1998-99, and it was carved from maple.
Okay.
if you're looking for a cheap prototyping material, maple is really, well, it's not so cheap, but it's a really good prototyping material. It's very strong, and the compression loads, it's very good, and it has a very, very fine grain, so it's very easy to work and get fairly precise shaping and so on. And it just grows on trees. You know, it's very sustainable from that point of view. You have no problem with the waste material because you can burn it, use it for fire, use it for heating, compost it or whatever. And we had a lot sitting around, so we used maple to build a hand which had, I think it had 16 movements in total. And we actuated it with the air muscles that we've been working with for many years, and we put some sensing on it, and we got it to the point where it could pick up a pint of beer in a straight glass. It had the flexibility and the strength to do that, but it was very, very, very definitely a prototype. We actually still have it in the workshop, and we show it to people occasionally. They go, what's that? This is a first prototype of a robot hand, but it's just wood and string and glue. Yes, that's what prototypes actually look like. So after that, we thought, well, this is interesting. Where can we go with this? And we built another version in aluminium and perspex, which was a much more classically robotic-looking object. You can look at it and you can go, oh, yes, I can see screws and I can see bearings and I can see fitted parts and machine-shaped parts and so on, not just stuff glued on where it would fit. And that built a hand with actually one more movement than our current hand has. We ended up with 6 movements in the base of the thumb because, well, the base of the thumb is a terrible, terrible joint. It's one of those things that, as an engineer, you look at it and you say, that was a mistake.
Okay.
It moves in 2 axes in the obvious way, but then it also has a certain degree of dislocation and relocation that's actually used. If you push hard on the end of the thumb, it locks into position. The anatomists have done cadaver studies of the thumb where they've taken the tip and pulled it in various directions and various forces, and then worked out what the kinematics must be from the location of the tip. And there are 3 different versions of the kinematics that are incompatible with each other that all come out of modelling. So, yeah, the human thumb is not a sensible engineering joint by any respect. So we ended up building a number of different variants of that. And the version we've settled on now has 5 separate movements and 1 axis that comes out at 45 degrees to all the others, because that gives it the same sort of range of movement as a human. But that came later in the process. The thumb on the second hand we built actually had 6 movements and could go right the way around the back and do some very, very strange things. That hand was, it was for us very impressive. It had 25, 26 movements. It had the same range of movements as a human hand. It wasn't very strong, but we took it to Japan in 2002 and impressed everybody at a big robot expo there, because no one had done that. It's a hand. We can shake hands with it. We can touch it. It was soft. It was compliant. It was flexible. It was a different approach to doing things. That made us think that we'd done something interesting. And we put some stuff up about it on our website, and then we started getting people phoning up going, can I use your hand for a research project? Well, we've only got one. Well, would you build me one? I guess so. Have you got some money? Yeah, I've got some money. And a couple of years later, we ended up selling them. First customer was the University of Bielefeld in Germany. They have it's a specific German, neuroinformatic research group, which is, there's no comparable word in English as far as I'm aware for what they do. But what they do is basically reverse engineer the brain and then build machines that operate in the same way. And they now have quite a huge, complex system that does speech understanding and task decomposition and planning and learning and manipulation and grasping. And we've seen some videos of their system working. We're like, how did you do that? That's really, really impressive. But they've been using, actually now, a pair of our hands for some years as the platform to do that research on, because it gives them reach and grasp and manipulate.
So you mentioned that the actuation is done with artificial muscles, but you've also got new models with different kind of actuation.
Yeah, we started out working with pneumatic muscles because the guy who set the founder of the company, Richard Greenhill, basically he invented a pneumatic muscle. Needless to say, when someone who knew the literature first saw it, they said, oh, that's a McKibben muscle. We know about McKibben muscles, they're not very good. And we know several senior Japanese professors of the time, late 80s, who said, oh, no, you can't build good robots with those kind of actuators, they're just not strong enough. Fortunately, he's one of those people who keeps working on an idea, and he worked out some very clever ways to build pneumatic artificial muscles that have let us build things that are very, very strong, and things that are very, very light, and things that are very, very flexible. If you've seen something like the Festo muscle, that's quite a mechanical engineering structure. It's stiff, it's rigid, it's heavy. You could probably hit someone on the head with it and really, really hurt them. As you see one of our muscles, it's soft, it's light, it's flexible. If you hit someone on the head, they just go, why are you doing that? And we've always tended to work that way with the muscle technology. So we've done a lot of projects where we've used those for things that work very close to humans, on humans, around humans, indeed even actually physically attaching the muscle to a person for a support brace or something. So the drawback with muscles is you need two of them to move a joint because they're antagonistic. So advantage and a disadvantage. And because they're both pulling, you've always got loading on the joint. From a control point of view, that's quite good because that actually makes the control quite easy. You can vary the stiffness. You can the compliance is great for getting somewhere and getting to the right place rather than the place you calculated, especially if you're doing grasping. But from an engineering point of view, it's terrible. You get a lot of wear just from the shock, just from the continuous loading of the joints. So as one joint moves, it's moving under load from the joints further down the kinematic chain, and that's causing a lot of extra friction, a lot of extra wear on there. In fact, if you stiffen up some joints, other joints hardly move at all. You can see this on your own hand. If you clench your fingers and thumb, and then you try and move the base of your thumb, it just becomes graunchy and jumpy, because essentially the tendons from the tip of the thumb are pulling the thumb base back into the socket there, and now it's no longer a free joint, it's a kind of jittery joint. So we wanted to get around this problem of the constant loading, the constant wear. And we also had some customers who said, we don't want to use pneumatics. People who, for whatever reason, don't want to use pneumatics. Compressors are heavy, often noisy. On a mobile platform, you may not even have the option of putting a compressor. You may be working in an environment where a compressor is just, use of pneumatics is just not acceptable. It's the classic external constraints changing the way you do your design. So we came up with a design for a single motor that drives a pair of tendons with force sensing that we thought could give us the same kind of compliance characteristics and the same kind of effectively antagonistic characteristics as a muscle just by doing very fast control of the motor. And that actually works rather well. We measure the force in both tendons, the motor responds very, very quickly, so we can set the hand into a compliant mode where it feels like there's no actuation at all, it's just not connected. You listen, you can hear the motors going zzz, 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 as you move the finger back and forwards. But as far as you're concerned, it's just free to move. And then we can stiffen it the other way, so as soon as you touch it, it reacts quite rigidly, and we've got the spectrum in between. So we now basically produce both versions of the hand, the pneumatic one, because some people prefer that, and the electric motor one, because other people prefer that.
You mentioned that your first client wanted to do research with your hand. Do you have other clients that have different kinds of applications? industrial?
At the moment, almost all of our customers are doing research in one area or another. Very, very broad spectrum of research, from people looking at the fundamentals of cognitive science through to, we actually have several customers in the US who are doing brain-computer interfacing. And essentially, they've got some connection to the brain, and they've got some electrodes to drive back into bits of the body to provide stimulus, and they connect the system through one of our hands because they want something interesting to control. They don't want to control a two-finger gripper. That's been done. There's plenty of people who've done on-off simple BCI systems. If you want to do an interesting BCI system, you want an interesting manipulator to control. And we're quite excited by that, because if they get that stuff to work, we can use that for possible real applications down the line. And also, if they get that to work, that means that prosthetics will eventually become very good rather than just okay. But yeah, most of our customers are in the research community. We're talking to a lot of people outside that community who have potential applications for our hardware, and primarily they're people who have difficult, dirty, and dangerous jobs. So by way of an example, we have a project starting this year within the ECHORD experiments, which is with a UK organisation called the Health Protection Agency. And they're the microbiologists who handle the stuff that everyone goes, well, I don't want to touch that. So, you know, they work with things like Ebola, anthrax, and so on. And that's what they work with every day. And they have guys who spend all day with their hands in glove boxes dealing with things that if you get a cut and infected with it, that's it. You're in quarantine for 48 hours. And if it develops, you're probably in quarantine for 2 weeks while you might or might not survive it. Obvious application for a robot. And we're going to see if we can use our technology for that. And there's a number of other people who are just working in areas where they currently, it's either they send a human in protective equipment and it's difficult to do, or they send a human somewhere that is just hard to get to, logistically difficult, and they would like to not have to do that, and can a robot be deployed at the other end so the human can control it safely? And we see a lot of potential in those areas for robots to do essentially telemanipulation. Offers a certain capability now, but with fully dexterous hands at the end of telemanipulation, we should be able to move people out of all kinds of difficult, dirty, and dangerous positions and just have them control robots doing that.
Okay. So what's next for your company? Are you developing something new?
We've got a few... Well, we're always improving the hand. In fact, stopping guys improving the hand and getting on with something else is always a challenge. But apart from just working on the hand itself, we've got a couple of designs for simpler hands that would be more applicable to what you might call less researchy contexts. If you want to use something for 10,000 cycles a month doing something fairly solid, then a simpler hand that's designed with that in mind would be more appropriate for the purpose. We're also looking, as you say, at various applications and working with several partners in those areas to try and find ways to get the hand into some of these places and actually doing some useful jobs. And we're always on the lookout for other interesting projects to do. One of the nice things about having spent half my life building robots is that I have a long list of people who come up and said to me, so if you can do that, can you do this for some very strange and weird value of this? And we've done everything from moving furniture for a Sheikh's penthouse. It was like a James Bond villain's lair. Lots and lots of white leather, lots and lots of screens popping out of things, a table that raised up and lowered itself, just all kinds of, just looking at going, oh dear, dearie me, dearie. But you know, that's what they wanted, they paid for. Through to building robots to work with dancers to investigate the conceptual space in between robotics and performance. And what happens when you bring performance techniques into the design and development of robots? Because for the performance people, they create things all the time. They have structured processes for doing creativity. As engineers, we don't do creativity. We avoid it like the plague. If you come up with an idea in a meeting, everyone goes, I don't think that'll work. I really don't think that'll work. Have you done a risk assessment? Has anyone else ever done this? So working with people and just trying that kind of technology transfer at the process level and seeing what happened. Absolutely fascinating project. Particular technical value, but you know, just kind of really interesting thing that people come to us and say, can you do this? Can you get involved? Are you up for that? And we usually are.
Well, thank you, Rich, for joining us on Robots.
No problem. Thanks, Adrian.
That's it for today's episode and the special series on the European Robots Forum. For more information on our guests and past episodes, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. And join us again in 2 weeks. Until then, goodbye. Go European with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.